This is The Interchange Recharged. I'm David Bandmiller. Welcome. One of the key topics of discussion at COP28 this year was the need to phase down fossil fuels. In hard-to-abate sectors, the use of carbon capture and storage to decrease emissions is seen as a key piece. The IEA estimates that CCS is expected to capture 6 billion tons of CO2 by 2050 and 1.5 billion tons in the next 6 or so years. Presently, though, is the technology scalable and is it too expensive? On the show today, we look at some of the innovations in CCS that are challenging these notions. Aker Carbon Capture is a provider with a few major projects underway, and they've signed an MOU with Microsoft to pursue joint innovation in the space. David Phillips is head of capital markets and new market strategy at Aker.
We build the actual carbon capture facilities for our customers in the emitting space in the industrial world. We're an early mover, so we actually are delivering 7 facilities in Europe right now, in Scandinavia and mainland Europe.
Hannah Rowland is head of sustainability at Aker.
It is very often not the core business of the company that are looking to deploy CCUS. So when we're talking with the smaller emitters, whatever we can do to make it easier for them to move forward with the solution is important, a way to reduce the barriers for deployment.
And Ole Henrik Rie is industry lead for energy at Microsoft. He'll explain later how carbon removal is advancing all the time and why CCS is top of Microsoft's ESG agenda. Hannah, Ole, David, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So we actually recently had our Wood Mackenzie CCUS Summit last month. Very, very interesting. Standing room only. So you could tell that there's a lot of energy around the space. A lot of people interested want to learn more about it. So David, why don't I start off with you? Tell us a little bit about Aker and what you actually do for them.
Well, so we're Aker Carbon Capture or Aker Carbon Capture, whichever pronunciation you like. I guess it depends which side of the Atlantic you're on. We build plants. We build the actual carbon capture facilities for our customers in the emitting space in the industrial world. We're an early mover, so we actually are delivering 7 facilities in Europe right now, in Scandinavia and mainland Europe. I guess the question for us really is, how did we get here? Because at the moment, not very many others are delivering plants of any size, be it fully industrial or modular or whatever. So although we've been a public company for about 3 years, we've really been around for about 20 years. Aker, as a wider group, a big industrial group in Norway, they've been involved in carbon capture since the late 1990s, working with Statoil, I use the old name deliberately, on the what's called the Sleipner field back in 1996. And that's really where we had our first sort of spark of interaction. Did a lot of R&D around carbon capture, the actual basic science and technology in the early 2000s. A lot of engineering hours also, developing a mobile test unit and a big plant in Mongstad in Norway, which is the world's largest and most advanced test facility for carbon capture using our type of technology. And since then, we've been developing our industrial arsenal, if you like. We have a list of modular offerings and large-scale plants as well. And, you know, over the years, we've developed a good IP footprint, and we're now at the point of delivering our very first plant in this cycle, which is in the Netherlands, and that's going to be ready in the next few months. So we really are delivering stuff in real life. As one of my colleagues put it, you know, we're not PowerPoint-based. We actually are delivering things in real life now. Me, I sit in London, but I've been here for 2 years. And I look after capital markets.
I wanted just to add to that from my perspective, following the company and sort of the core motivation to work with CCUS. And that is really that CCUS is the only group of technologies that contributes actually both to carbon reduction. So that is decarbonization of both industries and energies. And then also when it comes to carbon removal. So that is also referred to as negative emissions, truly the net zero. And I'm sure this is something that we can come back to.
And as I mentioned earlier, I mean, obviously, it's a very interesting space with a lot of momentum. Now, Ole, Aker recently signed a MOU with Microsoft. How does that fit in with Microsoft's ESG agenda and goals?
Yeah, hi, everyone. Ole Henrik, I'm an industry lead here in Microsoft. We signed an MOU with Aker because we found our strategies aligned. We had the same goals. This all started when Microsoft, about 3 years ago, announced our own ambitions, which were pretty groundbreaking at the time. We said that we would be carbon neutral by 2030, but also, more importantly, that we would remove our entire historical footprint of carbon by 2050. That's since the inception of our company in 1974. So obviously, to get there, we need carbon capture to happen at scale. And that's where we found a common goal with Aker.
It's a tremendous positive to have a company such as Microsoft with the name, the capability, the global reach joining with this initiative.
It has been a tremendous opportunity working together. We are garnering a lot of attention from everyone, and this is a very strong partnership, and it's something that we're really proud of. And going around, speaking at conferences, talking to customers, seeing these sort of two players come together has been really powerful.
On that note, Otto, remember we had this actually really nice event last week in Houston, where we, and this was as maybe as a sign, David, as to how close we've been working, where we had a, what we call sort of a Welcome to America event, very kindly on Microsoft's technology headquarters in Houston, or just outside Houston. We were there with a very informal list of presentations and chats and things and some technical comments, and then a lot of good networking, but really just to showcase us working closer together with a room full of potential customers and partners in the US. So very, very exciting indeed.
There's a couple different projects moving forward with Aker. There's cement, waste energy, bioenergy. Could you give us a little bit of background on each one of those?
Our first contract when we appeared in 2020 was with Heidelberg Materials, which is the Brevik CCS in Norway, big cement plant, a big old cement plant. And that's 400,000 tons a year. And we've been working on that for a while now, and that finishes later in 2024. So roughly 4 years from start to finish in terms of getting it ready. That's part of what's called the Longship program or policy in Norway, which is a very sort of, as they say, nose-to-tail model where the government's supporting both the emitters to build carbon capture, also to have transport in terms of marine transport around the coast of Norway, and then the famous Northern Lights Terminal, which is where the CO2 will be stored, you know, well under the North Sea. So we are part of that. So the first big project is Heidelberg Materials, Brevik CCS, ready in just over a year or so. The next one, which we were awarded in 2021, I think, or maybe early 22, was Twence. Twence is a waste-to-energy company in the Netherlands. It's a smaller facility, but this is our first modular plant. And maybe we'll come onto this in the discussion a bit later, but modular facilities for the small and medium and maybe even medium to large projects, maybe up towards between 500,000 and a million tons of CO2 a year, which is starting to get into a larger scale. The modular concept can address that with a lower cost, faster delivery, easier fabrication and construction, all the good stuff, you know, from modular stuff in any industry. Twence was the first mover, so a fantastic early partner to have. They actually are selling the CO2 into the Dutch horticultural market. So they're catching it from their waste energy plants, and then they're selling it into the domestic market, where it's going to help tomatoes, red peppers, and everything else grow more quickly. Now, you may think, well, isn't that just releasing it again? Well, it is, but the first version, before they caught CO2, was they had to, well, the industry would burn natural gas, so it would burn methane to create CO2, put in the greenhouse. So they're not burning methane anymore. So effectively, back to Hannah's comment about them being the net in net zero, this is sort of bringing that piece out. So effectively, the CO2 from their waste of energy is going into your next red pepper or tomato from Holland.
Excellent. And then we have the third project. As you mentioned, David, this is beyond PowerPoint. And the third project that we have under construction is together with the Microsoft and Ørsted on the bioenergy plants that they have in Denmark. And this really all started back to the ambitious climate targets that Ole Henrik mentioned for Microsoft. So soon after the establishment of Aker Carbon Capture back in 2020, we continued the conversation and sort of collaboration that already happened between Aker and Microsoft. And we saw the opportunities here to bring the conversation further together with Ørsted. And quite soon we then defined an MOU where we said that we were together accelerate a BECCS project. A couple of years back, this was and still is, I would say, an ambitious target. There were a lot of questions still on how we were to do that. But again, with our joint sort of strategic and sustainability targets that we really wanted to make this happen, we have really taken down barrier by barrier, and we're very pleased that in May this year we were able to take the final FID for the project jointly because of Microsoft's contribution and role in that, and also for the financing from the Danish state. So just a bit about what the project is about. Ørsted has taken a tremendous sustainability journey already. They have had a transition from coal-powered power plants, and now they're having straw-fired and wood chips-fired energy plants in Denmark. And when we are able, with our technology, to capture that CO2, that is how we can generate negative emissions or carbon removal. And very pleased by having a short timeline on this one, because it means that we can show impact quickly. And already towards 2025, we will be operational on these plants, enabling the capture of 430,000 tons of CO2, metric tons, that is, per year. So it's a really exciting project.
It's also quite a nice model of the modular concept as well. The whole point of modular, as I mentioned before, is to make it easy. And this, you know, there are two plants. One, as Hannah mentioned, the total is 430,000. One is roughly 200, one's roughly 300,000 tons a year, very roughly. Now, plan A is you have to order one plant that's 200,000 and one that's 300,000. The other route is you say you can order five of our Just Catch units and put two there and three there. So given these are retrofits, if you have enough space in the car park, which is a trivial comment, but if you have enough space in the car park, you can put your Just Catch modular units one next to each other. So it means that you hopefully be able to show that we can really stack these units and give our customers a very easy route, hopefully, to deploying carbon capture.
And as Hannah mentioned, this is a BECCS project, meaning it generates negative emissions. It's already a biomass-fueled power plant, meaning it's part of the existing CO2 cycle. Adding capture means you're actually removing CO2 from the atmosphere. So our role in this project very quickly became also as a carbon off-taker. We are a technology company. We are looking into providing technology to seamlessly map the digital value chain, mapping the physical value chain of CCS. But in this project, we also ended up as the off-taker and buying 2.67 million tons of CO2 over an 11-year period, one of the biggest negative carbon credit purchases in history.
David, you mentioned earlier about the reuse of some of the CO2. Out of curiosity, as you look forward, and you've obviously got the storage aspect and you can reuse, what percentage or how much of the CO2 capture do you actually think can be reused versus stored?
Now, that's a great question. It's one of the, I'll say what's one of the classic known unknowns. So firstly, apart from putting it into a greenhouse, which is simply using CO2 as CO2, the great majority of all the idea of using it, the other acronym, the U in CCUS, or let's just say CCU, the whole point of CCU is to turn it into something else. So fuel, so you can have like a, an e-fuel for your car or plane or a ship or something, or use it to make chemicals or something else useful in the chemical supply chain, manufacturing chain, or use it to cure concrete or make other building aggregate materials. Now, all of that stuff sounds very nice, but there's a reason it's not happened in any great scale so far, is that CO2 is a very stable molecule. That's why it hangs around. So you have to break it up, and it needs energy, it needs heat and everything else to transform it. So whatever you make, whatever your, let's call it blue to be crude, your blue fuel is going to be two or three or four times as expensive as the one you can get from a pump now. And the same for any chemical, and the same for aviation fuel and stuff. But then again, this is a new industry, so you need scale to really pull it. And it's obvious that there are certain markets that don't have much other choice. So shipping, as you've seen with some big investments with or big plans from players like Maersk. In airlines, there are a lot of them, United Airlines, for instance. There's a lot of co-investment into SAF, or sustainable aviation fuel. Because if you fly long haul, there aren't many other choices, at least for the next couple of decades too. And there's no hydrogen planes or battery power planes or something. Maybe very, very short distances, but long, you need to have some type of decarbonized or low carbon fuel. So it all sounds great, but you need the market needs to develop. It's classic chicken and egg scenario. You need to have the demand to pull to develop it to make it cheaper. And it's starting. It's starting. But the overall scale though, if you assume that we do achieve the decarbonization that everyone is hoping for in the next, let's say 20 years, the share that's from CCU is by definition just a lot smaller than CCS. So the industrial stuff you capture from cement and other power generation and so on, that's going to be, there are lots of numbers out there, 80%, 7% of the market or something. It's the great majority is to store it, to decarbonize industry. The fuel part, or let's say that the CCU part, is going to be a bit smaller. That being said, it could be more interesting in the next, let's say medium term than long term, because in the medium term, there's a great need to find decarbonized routes for products and fuels and so on that could be, it's a very exciting new market. And as you probably know, the storage angle for CCS is one of the obvious bottlenecks that slows things down. So other options are, if we can't store it, what else can we do? Well, we can try and turn it into aviation fuel. Okay. And we've seen this, especially in the last, maybe in the last sort of year or so, maybe 18 months, there's been an obvious acceleration in the engineering studies we get in from customers looking to do, as I say, e-methanol, so let's say CO2 to chemicals, or e-fuels, CO2 to fuels and so on. So you can see the momentum coming. Ultimately, though, the storage work is going to be the bigger one.
Who would be best to answer on CCUS as a service?
I'll give it a shot if you like. No, so there's a concept that we looked at, or we still have that we're looking at, called Capture as a Service, or Carbon Capture as a Service. The idea, very simply, is that you would have a consortium of pieces of the value chain working together. So us doing the capture, building it and operating it, someone else with a pipeline or some other transport, and then the storage. And all of that will be under one umbrella. And there'd also be a financial partner to do some sort of clever sell and lease back. So effectively you rent the whole thing rather than buying it. But that all ends up giving the customer just one price. So effectively, rather than spending up front to buy something, you pay a certain rent or toll per year. It could be linked to the carbon price. It could be long-term fixed price. There are lots of variables in there. The idea being just to make it easier. And we actually had the idea when we appeared in 2020, it was an idea more for the long term. You know, let's get the industry up and running, get the first projects running, and then see how this service option might pick up some interest. What actually happened in 2021, you know, that the EU carbon price, which is the, as you know, the stick that everyone's trying to avoid by decarbonizing, at least in Europe, the EU carbon price went up pretty aggressively, above 50, then towards 100 in the second half of the year, euros per ton. And that, I think, changed, we certainly felt that changed the interest of many of our smaller customers in terms of being a bit more urgent. So we had a number of smaller players coming to us saying, well, we need help because we thought we could wait until 2026 or 27 or 28, and we have to maybe do it now or soon. So what can we do? So we looked at a number of cases. We had we were spoiled for choice in terms of financial partners to work with us, no question. Infrastructure funds, money from Asia and so on. So we had a good choice on that side. We were very close to some contracts, actually, in late 21, early 22. But they didn't work out in the end because 2022, as you may have spotted, 2022 was quite a disruptive year. Rates went up a lot, so the cost of capital went up a lot. And in each case, the couple of these opportunities we're looking at, these projects, needed to raise money to build a green fuel plant onto which we would build a carbon capture piece. And they're still waiting for that financing. So I think these early movers will still come, probably in the next 12 to 18 months, maybe 24 months, so that they're still there. But the idea, interestingly enough, I know we'll talk about the US in a little bit as well, we didn't lead with this in our initial US efforts because, firstly, the US was big enough anyway, but secondly, because of all the financial challenge that we've got from 2022. Now, actually, we've been asked about it quite a lot, so we're having to sort of, you know, revisit some of our models and thoughts around it. But the idea, very, very simply, is just that it makes it easier for, especially for smaller companies, to think about deploying carbon capture without having to, you know, dig into their wallets to pay the CapEx upfront.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more because we had a number of discussions around this at our conference. And when I looked at you guys exploring the CCUS as a service, it seems like that's the way to go, right? Because first of all, people that want to take advantage of it don't necessarily have the capital availability to be able to put into it. But it operates very similar to the oil and gas midstream business, particularly here in the US. So they offer, hey, we take away your gas, we treat it. It also saltwater disposal for oil and gas as well. And that has really taken off. And so we look at these midstream companies in particular, looking at, you know, how can we take part of the energy transition? And this is actually a logical fit because there's some infrastructure there that they can expand on. So that really seems like that is the model that will really accelerate the adoption and ability to capture the CO2 and get it out of the environment.
Yeah, absolutely. The one last comment on the capture the service model. In Europe, we have seen a few examples that ironically have been changed from capture the service opportunities to more traditional sale because of government funding. And so someone may have thought, I need to accelerate this. How can I do it? This sounds like a nice idea. Capture the service. I can move it to the OPEX line, everything fantastic. Then the government funding round pops up where you can get maybe, I don't know, half of your CapEx paid if you win the funding round. So, well, hang on. If someone's going to pay me half my CapEx for free, then I want to do that instead. So I mean, we still sell it. So it doesn't affect our opportunity, but it means that then maybe the number of that at least early on, the number of these capture the service opportunities is maybe a bit less than we thought, let's say 2 years ago.
And I think that is an important notion also when it comes to deployment of CCS in general. It is very often not the core business of the company that are looking to deploy CCS. So when we're talking with the smaller emitters, as you say, David, whatever we can do to make it easier for them to move forward with the solution is important, a way to reduce the barriers for deployment.
Oli, as you look at CCUS kind of starting out and starting to gain traction, how do you feel the partnership with Microsoft and Aker can help bring that forward a little bit and really accelerate the adoption and, you know, maybe saving some of the years off of where we would be, you know, say 10 years from now? This partnership can help accelerate that to maybe 5 years.
So our ambition with our investments have certainly been to accelerate the market. That's why we have been an early mover in procuring carbon credits. As we mentioned in the Ørsted project, we procured 2.67 million tons. That's a major part of the financing of that project. We are running an open RFP as we speak. That's been open for 2.5 years where we're still accepting offers from the market for carbon credits. It's been a process where we've learned a lot. In the beginning, almost 90% of all the offers we received were rejected because either they weren't actually negative emissions, it was avoidance, or there was no permanence, or etc. So we published a set of criteria that we think is going to help shape the market. In lack of any proper international standards or government standards, we are using our criteria as sort of a baseline. And I know a lot of the emitters in the industry are looking at those as sort of the benchmark they need to reach. On top of that, we're also in the background with the Ørsted project, with the Breivik project that's been mentioned, and even Twence. We're trying to develop a digital backbone that makes this easy, because the measurement, the reporting, the verification of these projects is hard. And it's something that we think that by doing it digitally, we can help accelerate that process as well. We are looking for the next big Ørsted project together. As David mentioned, the US launch, we had a lot of customers there and a lot of interesting conversations with US customers, looking into if we can find the next joint project that we can engage in together. And nothing would please us more than to see a US project getting off the ground quickly.
And if I may add to that, actually how Microsoft is really contributing and by the support towards their Ørsted project is that the technology that captures the CO2 doesn't differ whether it's fossil or biogenic. So whatever project that we are able to move forward really helps the next project to follow. So with having the first entire value chain development now taking place in Denmark, where it will be capture and also combination of different capture sites to transport that further for permanent storage in the North Sea, that really opens up a possibility for other emitters to connect, whether it's with biogenic emissions or fossil emissions. And I think that is at least something I try to emphasize whenever I'm out talking about carbon capture, what this really is, and the importance of doing some of the right choices towards setting your own strategies on decarbonization and also the application of carbon removal towards your net zero goals.
Hey, going back to your discussion around carbon credits, it's something that, you know, over the past several years continues to be a topic of discussion. And I think over the next couple of years, we're going to be discussing them even more. For those listeners that may not be as familiar with the carbon credits, can you give a little bit of a discussion around how they work and how Microsoft really approaches when they're evaluating things?
So basically what I started by saying is that we will remove our entire historical footprint. Now, there's no way of removing that footprint without actually removing carbon from the atmosphere. So we're driving those negative projects. And right now, that's basically DACs or BECs. So bioenergy or direct air capture projects is what we're looking at. We have invested in DACs projects, most famously the one in Iceland that everyone knows about, but also certainly now with the BECs projects with Ørsted. Carbon credits is actually when you've captured that ton of CO2 that you've removed from the atmosphere, that becomes a tradable commodity. That commodity is something we buy and then deduct from our footprint. We haven't been using carbon offset mechanisms for our company, but we are actually buying these negative credits. There are several sort of different types of them. We haven't said that we only will be doing DACs, only BECs, only technology-based. We are looking at nature-based solutions as well. And basically what we've said publicly is that we're looking for a balanced portfolio of projects to get us to our goals.
Yeah, one of the things we're probably going to have in the podcast here at some point is a session on carbon credit pricing and how that's working. That's going to be a whole other discussion.
That's interesting.
Yeah. It's kind of funny. I've recently heard more and more a little bit. We previously heard getting to net zero, true or absolute zero, and now I'm hearing net negative thrown out there a little bit more. So a lot of focus, but all moving in the positive direction.
The net negative side is interesting because one question we often have, not so much around BECs, but around direct air capture, which is a different concept entirely, but, you know, as you're taking it straight out of the atmosphere, that is a much more emerging technology, very expensive right now, a lot of R&D to do and stuff. But there's a lot of money being thrown at it, a lot of funding in the US, for instance. I remember really asking some of the policymakers there, why do you throw billions of dollars at this technology that will probably take 10 years before it'll be in the right range to actually be economical, even given nice customers and third parties like Microsoft and others to buy some of the removals. And they said, well, our net zero math by 2050 doesn't work without it. We can get down by efficiency, renewables, blah, 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 carbon capture that we do. But then you need to then take another slice out of the bottom of the cake to get you absolutely down. So you need that 8, 10%, whatever it is, of that emission pool has got to be taken out directly. So it's a fascinating area. Maybe that's your second podcast on the carbon market.
Yeah, we actually had a podcast last year discussing the technology about capture of the air. And you're right. It's still about, you know, 7-10 years away from really being effective, but it is something that's going to be needed. That technology is going to continue to develop.
But I think it's really important to look at what is available today. And we know that we have a lot of point sources that with the technology that we are, as we said, delivering now, is available to actually capture and remove large volumes of CO2. And when we talk about these numbers, it's often hard to understand what is truly the impact. But we said, like, with the projects that we're doing together now with Ørsted, it's 430,000 tons, metric tons, every year. So that is really large volumes if we compare to other opportunities, or there are not really these kind of volumes available that it is being delivered today. And of course, the market is, we're talking here bioenergy as an example, but we have other existing emission points being pulp and paper industry. We are going to continue to use paper moving forward as well. I would call that a hard debate in a way. It's definitely an industry that will live with us long beyond 2050. We have waste to energy. I think that is an extremely interesting industry because we know that we need to move waste from landfills. That is the majority of how waste is managed today. With its huge emissions when it comes to methane, it is actually better to at least incinerate it. If we can incinerate it and use the energy after, that is a plus. And I would say that, okay, best in class here, let's have waste to energy and then include CCS. And we are both doing the reduction part of the fossil elements, and we are enabling the removal part through the biogenic part of the waste. So this is really to use what is already available to us to mitigate climate change.
It's looking at all those different sectors. I mean, to get to a true circular economy, those initiatives and those technologies are going to have to be developed for just those reasons. You know, one of the things I found also interesting from the conference that we had last month was I didn't realize when I was looking at one of the charts and they were looking at the carbon capture costs associated with different types of plants. And natural gas was a lot higher than coal. And I would have thought it was the complete opposite, but it had to do with the concentration of the CO2 in the coal plant versus the gas. What are some of those other kind of nuances that you're finding as you're looking at these initiatives, really as it relates to cost on areas where it's really efficient, cost-effective to do it, where others may be a little bit more costly at this point until technology continues to develop?
We published a view across the entire value chain looking at what we call levelized costs. So in other words, if you were to buy a plant from us and have a long-term agreement to capture your CO2 from your plant and then store it somewhere, what would your on average cost per year be across that time frame? And that's sort of the cost you'd look at if you were comparing it with a carbon price, for instance. And that you see what really are the bigger chunks in that. There's quite the CapEx piece is not so large, really. So the actual hard steel that you build the plant out of, it's a certain range, and it has come down a lot actually in the last years. I mean, our modular plant now, the Just Catch that we're supplying to Ørsted, is something like 90% cheaper than the big plant we built back in 2012. So modularizing, going through several sort of iterations of making it smaller and cheaper and more simple and stuff, you can do a lot there. But the bigger numbers you can really push when it comes to the cost are the operating costs, because a large part of your operating cost is energy. So actual heat to reverse the reaction to generate the CO2 to capture it again, and also the transport and storage, which is very simply down to where you are. If you're near the storage, it's not so high. If you're a long way away, it's going to be very high. Now, of course, one of those you can't really change unless you find storage near you. But the operating cost bit is something that we've done a lot of work on and looking at what's called recycling waste heat. So both from our own facility and also from the thing you're capturing CO2 from, if you can recycle that heat, you can really reduce your cost versus, let's say, a sort of standard off-the-shelf alternative. If you can recycle both of those heat sort of areas, you can reduce your cost by 4 or 5 times. So you can really bring the cost down by recycling heat. Now, you can't always do that. Not every single plant is perfectly positioned physically to be able to do that. But most have a lot you can do. The one we're doing for Heidelberg Materials, actually, is an almost one-to-one offset of the heat they need and the heat that we can recycle from the plant. So a big old plant that gives off a lot of heat is actually a very nice target for us. But your question is a very good one around the level of CO2, because this is also, of all those other variables, there's operational stuff and storage and where you are and pipelines and ships and things. Those all drive the cost. But also, the gas to power is more like 3 or 4, maybe 4.5% of CO2 in your exhaust gas that you're trying to catch the CO2 from. Waste of energy is more like 8, 9, 10. If you look at coal, it's mid-teens. Cement is high teens, maybe even low 20s. Hydrogen is more like mid-20s and higher. If your exhaust, if quarter of it is CO2 versus only a 20th or 5%, that's a different game. And surprise, surprise, if you ask a scientist, it's not a straight line. It's a nice curve. But when you get down to below 3 or 4%, it starts to get quite challenging to do it with the systems that are ready to go in the market right now. But 4 or 5%, yes, very possible. And actually, I think we've probably got one of the broader ranges of experience across the capture space at the moment of looking at gas to power, waste to energy, refining, coal and others. We've got, about, I think, 63,000 hours at the moment of data that we've collected over the last sort of 10, 12 years across different industries. So we know how they all perform. And we know that when you start off, you're like, oh my goodness, how is this ever going to work properly? But after you tweaked it and worked with it, you can make it work. And the ones we're doing, they're not being built yet, unfortunately, hopefully soon. But the ones in the UK we're involved with, there are two very large gas to power projects. These are new builds, so new plants with BP and SSE. And those are large gas to power plants. And you're looking at sort of 90% plus, more like 95% carbon capture or CO2 capture with those. So it can be done, but it certainly has a challenge, yeah.
Looking forward at some of the barriers to the industry as you look to expand. I mean, clearly, I think infrastructure is obviously one of them. There's a tremendous amount of investment that needs to go into that. But besides looking at infrastructure, what other barriers do you see that kind of need to be addressed in order to really get things moving forward at the right momentum?
Well, I can start from the buyer side of the table. And what we're seeing is that a lack of standards and regulations and slow-moving bureaucracy in terms of approving projects, etc., is really slowing down the development right now. Looking at the market here in Europe, the big gap right now is storage. There just isn't storage available. What's there is sold out, and getting new projects online, getting new storage capacity online takes way too long because of the reasons I said, lacking regulations or regulations being invented as we move, and then the time it takes to get approvals, etc.
I think it comes down to predictability from the emitter side, that it sort of has to start on that end of the value chain. And for them, it's the regulations, as you say, Ole, and it's also about either the cost of polluting, even though we see a steep increase that has been over the last years. We know that the EU ETS, for instance, is bound to go down on the allowances for any emitters. And then it's the unknown around what is the value of any carbon removal that the plant could generate. So that's why it's important with these first movers that could go in there, could have long-term contracts to sort of get the starting phase off the ground. And I think also what we could do about it to have sort of the upside here as well is to support on that side as anyone that demand either it's a low carbon material or it is on the carbon removal side to go in and support and sort of provide that predictability as well would it be a huge support for any emitter. Just let's take US concrete as an example. We know that the US officials, I would say, or government side, would be procuring 50% of all concrete that is being produced in the US over a year. To go in there and set some demands of what are the emissions or the carbon intensity of the product that they produce, that would really generate that predictability for the producer and to move forward to deploy CCS.
Yeah. Just to echo also all those comments, but also from what Ole said about storage, I mean, as we see it, very simply, we are not the long lead item or the longest lead item in the value chain. If you've not started yet, you can order a smaller plant from us and deliver it in maybe a little bit under 2 years. A medium-sized one, maybe 2 and a bit. A larger modular one, maybe 2.5 towards 3. And a big one, maybe 3, 3.5. Storage, if you've not started, think of a number. I mean, it's at least in Europe, you're talking about offshore storage. And that's, you're doing effectively reverse oil and gas. You have to get a license, go and find the space, do your seismic, drill it, prove it up, then start to work out how you'll market it and what the cost will be and everything else. If it's oil and gas, that takes, you know, 7, 8 years, it may be more, from start to actual production. Now, in the storage piece, the reverse process, you can overlap a lot of that, those stages, because the risk is different. You know, you're putting back in, not taking out, and so on. So in that, you're still looking at maybe 4 years plus to develop a store, something like that. Now, this is well understood. So EU, Norway, UK has been pretty proactive in pushing out new licenses in the last couple of years. 20-something from the UK this year, several from Norway, more coming out across offshore the rest of Europe. So it's a known issue. But at the moment, if you look what is planned, so I mean, right now, zero exists. But in the next couple of years, Northern Lights will start in Norway, then Greensand and so on in Denmark, and then other ones in the UK and elsewhere. So it'll come. But let's say by 2029, 2030, how much planned storage is there? And it's a bit above 100 million tons a year of CO2. Let's say 110. Now, we mapped the industrial footprint in Europe and say, well, okay, if it all existed, if there was plenty of storage, how much could you stuff into the North Sea in 1 year? 200, 250. So you're only halfway there. So that's the gap. And that's the sort of the challenge that, you know, the classic known unknown that the industry is now trying to accelerate their way through.
It's definitely an issue. I mean, not just with carbon capture and storage, but just other different technologies in the energy transition as well. A number of people have said the problem is the backlog, the regulatory approval. Let's face it, government's never been known to move swiftly. But when you add on new technologies in kind of a heightened focused area, nobody wants to make the wrong call. And it just seems to be delaying. And it's a problem of how can you accelerate? Because clearly it's needed, desired. And if you do accelerate the pace of development and approval and permitting process, all that, you can accelerate the energy transition, but you still have that disconnect between the two.
Yeah, it's a good point. I mean, the glass half full view is that you'll get over some of these red tape migraines in the first few projects, and then there's going to be a very sharp learning process, and then hopefully the next ones will be quicker. I mean, for instance, insurance. How do you insure against storing CO2 in the North Sea? And it's not just the risk of the subsurface bit, the one that's a few kilometers below the seabed. It's not just that. It's also all the pipeline and network and stuff and infrastructure. It's the carbon price impact if you don't catch it. So if you don't catch the CO2. So if, for instance, you have some accident, heaven help us, but if you have to stop because there's been a problem and you're offline for a month, you're emitting CO2. So also there's a cost of a month of you emitting CO2 and paying whatever the CO2 price is. But that insurance, that sort of very, I would say, complicated insurance picture, as I understand it, at least in the UK, is now being sorted out. And actually, they're very, very close to finalising. They actually already have finalised the structures around how they're going to have this sort of multi-phase insurance across the storage piece. And obviously, once you've done that, next one is like, well, use that one. So hopefully, you will see quite a good learning curve, I hope.
Yeah, that's actually an interesting point. Because I mean, here, you know, with the Gulf of Mexico, you've got the P&A costs and liabilities for wells that are drilled there. But it's how people can evaluate the difference between that and a storage, which may be very similar, maybe not, but you know, government has to evaluate that in order to be able to continue. And then insurance, you're right, insurance being able to evaluate that in addition. David, so what was the thought process in terms of looking at the U.S.? I mean, we've talked a little bit about differences in the U.S. and the European markets, but as you look, what was it about the U.S. that has kind of said that's something that we want to pursue?
Yeah, good question. I mean, there's a very detailed answer. The short one is it's very big and just woken up. that's the real world why it's such an exciting market for us. There's a big industrial footprint. Like everything in the US obviously is bigger. But in particular, the CO2 footprint is, I think all in is roughly 5 billion tons of CO2. And half of that is the interesting bit to us because half of that is the industrial bit. So industrial energy. The other half is transport and other stuff. But that's sort of 2.5 billion. And of course, 2.5 billion, a lot of that's going to be the wrong place. So let's assume it's even half that again. You're still a number that's several times as big as Europe. So the pond literally looks quite attractive. Then you also have a number of industries that we know very well. So you don't have to go reinvent our science, our technology, and our approach. We can look at refining, we can look at power generation and so on. And there's a lot of map we can do across that. So it really comes down to how can we accelerate things most quickly? But for us, it's more the Inflation Reduction Act that woke up just over a year ago. That's really catalyzed a lot of interest. And I think that the famous $85 that you get for catching and storing CO2, it's not necessarily the right number, but it's a good start. And of course, if it was 100, you could do more. And obviously, it was 50 what it was before, less things worked. But now at 85, you can see maybe some of the best projects have a good chance of moving ahead without any other issue in terms of maybe not needing help from negative emission credit sales and so on. But for us, it's a very exciting market. We have a lot to do. We have a lot to learn how to Americanize our approach and to work with the value chain and so on. But as we mentioned early on, I think both Hannah and Ollie mentioned, you know, there's stuff that's very interesting for our little partnership here as well. I mean, there's pulp and paper with the biogenic angle. And you know, again, back to the famous Ørsted Denmark contract, that really woke up interest in that space to see how the three of us, Microsoft, Aker, Carbon Capture, and Ørsted, how the three of us would align and make something work really in a very exciting way. And I think that it could well be the first movers in the US are going to be in this area as well.
I would add on a personal note, visiting the US and meeting customers together over the past weeks has been tremendously positive experience, because we are now sitting down with customers discussing positive income streams. We are looking at the government incentives plus the potential of selling credits on top, actually creating an income stream, a positive net result, which just is a very different discussion than what we're having in Europe.
Yeah, I was actually going to ask you, David had brought up the IRA as one of the pieces in terms of their evaluation of the U.S. market. How has that impacted your business and how you're evaluating opportunities?
Well, we have this concept of additionality, which is very important to us, that any project that we buy credits from would need to prove additionality. That means that we would not buy credits from a project that was self-funding. So our money needs to go to actually realizing the project. Now, in order to make the Ørsted case work, the Ørsted case is partly government funded. We have to rewrite those rules a bit. So our criteria have now been updated to allow for a joint funding. So we are okay with government funding partly and then still selling credits on top of it, because we realized that's the only way this project would be realized.
So David, Hannah, as you look at the projects in the overall financial markets, how have you seen the interest from the investment community in general on CCUS projects? I've got to imagine that over the past 3 years, we're light years ahead of where we were in terms of interest and capital availability. But could you just talk a little bit about how you've seen that develop?
Yeah, I think even though the rate environment is somewhat more challenging than it was in the free money era in 2021 and before, the amount of, if you like, green finance that is looking for a home, be it infrastructure, private equity, VC, or climate tech solutions, or normal equity, is pretty tremendous. And the reasons it's not moved ahead, and the reasons are the projects haven't happened yet. So, you know, the back to all the comments we said before about, you know, about storage and everything else, all the issues of red tape and so on, all the issues that have slowed down the progress of projects, that we're now just starting to see those first steps that we're very delighted to be involved in. But behind that, the money that's waiting to really play a game is tremendous. And one that, when we were looking at, back to the carbon capture the service concept you asked about a while ago, when we were looking for the financial partners for that, as I said, we had a disorderly queue outside of our offices in Oslo and London and elsewhere. But the challenge, funnily enough, people come to us and say, cool, we'd love to invest in carbon capture. This is the future. We've got to get involved. How big is it? And he said, well, we're just doing our first project now. It's like, oh. And someone who's just puts $500 million into a pipeline in the Middle East or something then has to really understand that this is early days right now. But this is understood now. And I think what we may be seeing this whole process mature a bit. So the big infrastructure players that we have had some very, very good dialogues with, they are really looking at sort of scalable multi-year programs. So, and this works really well with a modular solution, by the way. But if you can, you have a certain pot of money that will support carbon capture. And from that, you have certain withdrawals into each project. So over time, over, let's say, I'm making a number up here, but over 5 years, you achieve the sort of scale they want. But you have to start early. So there's a bit of a, I would say, a bit of a sort of a size criteria they have to get their head around. But yeah, I think the availability is pretty good, I must say.
Perhaps not so much on the financial side, but I often talk with colleagues that has worked in this area for decades. And I see upon myself as quite impatient. And while I'm impatient now, let's not forget what we started off with our discussion with. This is actually happening now. We have projects that is being in construction now. And that is not the case a couple of decades ago, where we saw that the world was not really prepared for taking the urgency to act. And I'm very pleased to see that this has changed now. And it's a matter more about how do we do it and should we do this? And I think that is a very important step change.
Companies like Microsoft working in the industry and putting their capital to use as well to help drive it forward. Listen, I really appreciate your time today. Interesting discussion, as always, very, very timely, particularly around this subject. Early stages, David, as you mentioned, but really looking forward to see how it continues to develop and some of the projects that you're working on along with Microsoft and how they develop and where they are in a few years from now. So thank you again.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you.